Hello, and welcome to this presentation that tells the story of Frederick John Cato. The county of Bedfordshire in southern England has been the home for many generations of the Cato family. Indeed, the Cato name is still a common one in this region. Our story will begin with the birth of William Cato, who was born in the Bedfordshire town of Leighton Buzzard in 1797. William decided that the agricultural life in his hometown didn't give him enough opportunity, and so he decided to move to the Big Smoke of London in the early 1800s. Here he met and married Elizabeth Burgess in 1818. Between that time and 1828, the Cato family grew with the birth of five children. At this time, there was a lot of chatter and news promoting the opportunities for English settlers to travel across the world to the newly established settlements that were opening up in Australia. In particular, the Swan River settlement was seen as a great opportunity for colonists. The Cato family decided to take this opportunity to make a new and exciting life and signed up for this new venture. Unfortunately for the Catos, and indeed for all others concerned, the Swan River settlement was not a success. And as a result, many of the colonists began to seek out other opportunities. William managed to find a position based in Hobart Town in Van Diemen's Land and arrived by ship in early 1831, with the family following some 2 months later. William and Elizabeth took up the positions of overseer and sub-matron at the Female House of Corrections, better known colloquially as the Female Factory. This property was located in the Cascades area of South Hobart, adjacent to what is now the site of the Cascades Brewery. Since many of the female convicts were pregnant upon their arrival, Elizabeth found herself in the added position as acting as midwife for the establishment. In this role, she was instrumental in bringing many of Tasmania's first-born white babies into this world. This slide gives you an opportunity to view the layout of the female factory with Mount Wellington lurking in the background. The image dates back to 1827. The Catos shared the view that fair and lenient treatment of their charges was appropriate. As a result, Elizabeth made a point of ensuring that those expectant and feeding mothers should have sufficient nutrition available to them to support their baby. At the time of their appointment, Van Diemen's Land was ruled by Lieutenant Governor Arthur, who strongly supported William and Elizabeth in their enlightened approach to the management of the inmates. Unfortunately, Governor Arthur was replaced by John Franklin at the end of 1836, and Franklin had a very different view about the treatments of convicts and felt that the Catos were not sufficiently strict or tough on the inmates. As a result, the decision was apparently made to replace them. It appears that the Cato family was set up by the Franklin bureaucracy in a plot that would provide grounds to remove them from their position. Reports from the time tell that an unannounced raid was executed on William and Elizabeth's home one evening, and that as a result, both were charged with being in possession of unauthorised property from government stores. It was understood that evidence against the Catos was provided by a discontented prisoner and a police informer. The unauthorised property referred to in the charges in fact consisted of a chook that was being boiled on the oven to create some Jewish penicillin broth for the new mums. As a result of this, the family found itself needing to find a new home. Through a contact, William managed to secure a small allotment of land in the Richmond region north of Hobart. A small cottage was built on the site, and William started a market gardening business. However, his health had deteriorated significantly, and as a result, William died of dysentery in April 1843. Elizabeth survived William by only 8 months, until she too fell victim to typhoid. Two children, Sophia, aged 19, and Edward, then aged 15, had still been living with mum and dad, and therefore were in need of support. Sophia and Edward were taken in by an uncle who had followed William and Elizabeth to Van Diemen's Land, and in fact established the Tasmanian apple industry. However, once Sophia got married and moved out, Edward decided in 1848 to leave the island and follow his dreams on the mainland. He travelled to Adelaide and managed to obtain an apprenticeship with Thomas Nimmo, an Adelaide carpenter and builder. The following year, Edward married Thomas Nimmo's daughter, Catherine. He completed his apprenticeship with his father-in-law before moving with his wife to Melbourne. However, the lure of the gold rush proved too much for Edward, and in 1857, the family pulled up stumps and decided to head westward. Mum, Dad, and their three children headed out on the road through Ballarat and Ararat, and eventually reached the Pleasant Creek diggings, more than 150 miles from Melbourne. Records of the time showed that in 1857, Pleasant Creek supported about 7,500 men, 700 women, 400 children, and about 50 or so Chinese miners as well. The conditions on the goldfields were far from comfortable in those days. Not only was there substantial crowding, but the terms of each claim required that they be worked at least 6 days a week. And in fact, even simple things like obtaining fresh water were at a premium. The ground was littered with shafts and obstructions. Most housing on the diggings consisted of canvas tents, with a few wattle and daub huts starting to appear. These conditions resulted in a broad range of health-related problems, without the medical support available in the larger towns. It was into these conditions that Frederick John Cato was born on the diggings in May of 1858. This slide gives an artist's impression of life on the Victorian diggings at about this time. By 1860, most of the surface and alluvial gold at Pleasant Creek had been gathered, and many of the miners decided to simply pack up and move on to the next big dig. At this time, the bigger syndicates started to move in, bringing heavy machinery to search for gold further down under the ground in shafts. The Cato family decided not to drift away, but moved down the hills into the township that was beginning to form. The name of the township of Pleasant Creek was changed to Stawell in the year 1861. As the town developed, more substantial buildings began to appear along the main street, and houses began popping up to replace the rough shanties. This slide shows an early photograph of Stawell at about this time. The mechanised mining equipment can be seen just beyond the main street. The Cato family settled into town and built a small house in Barnes Street, next door to the Pleasant Creek Common School, number 502. Alas, Fred's home is no more. The land was taken over by the school as it expanded, and Stawell State School, still located on the premises, and still sports the number 502. Fred didn't begin his schooling at number 502 until he'd reached 8 years of age. But he soon became enthused about learning and eventually caught up with and indeed surpassed most of his school companions. On completing his school education, young Fred decided to try his hand at a range of different industries. He worked as a grocer's boy, a wheelwright, and a machine operator in a mine. However, he decided that it was teaching that appealed to him most. He undertook additional training and achieved his teaching qualifications in 1876. Once he qualified, Fred was appointed to the position of pupil teacher at school number 502. His class consisted of some 60 pupils. This is a photo of young Fred standing beside the pupils in his class at the school. As you can see, this class size is certainly bigger than the ones you'll see today. In 1877, Fred's parents decided that the grass appeared greener elsewhere in Victoria. At that time, parts of Gippsland were being opened up for selection. Edward travelled by train towards Sale and decided to go exploring some land near Waterloo, now called Yarragon. He marked a 320-acre block at Nardine West, some 16 miles from Waterloo. Once his selection had been approved, Mum, Dad, and the three youngest children made the trip from Stawell to Gippsland. Once the rest of the family had left Stawell, Fred began to feel less settled in his position and decided to look at other possible teaching opportunities. New Zealand had just introduced new regulations at the time, and these mandated state-supported public education. As a result, there was a major push to encourage teachers from Australia to travel across the ditch and to take up teaching roles. As a result, Fred decided to take up the challenge, and in 1879, he arrived on the west coast of New Zealand en route to the gold mining settlement of Kamara. However, it turned out that Kamara Society and Fred Cato did not make a good fit, and so he sought a teaching position at other locations in New Zealand. He accepted a position in the town of Frankton, which has now become a suburb of Queenstown. This was an agricultural community, very staid and much less vibrant than that of Kamara. However, seemingly hard to please, Fred decided to seek a position in a larger settlement where the community offered a broader range of cultures. He was successful in obtaining a teaching role at the District High School in Invercargill. This school had a large classroom in which the boys sat at one end with a male teacher, Fred, and the girls at the other end with a lady teacher by the name of Frances Bethune. Alas, eventually Fred decided that teaching simply didn't offer him the pleasure that he had expected, although the same could not be said about his interactions with Fanny Bethune. During 1881, Fred received a message from Edward Moran, a cousin by marriage. Edwin had established a grocery business in Melbourne with two shops. He had decided to contact Fred with an invitation to return home and assist him in running his enterprise, with the possibility of a partnership in the offing. Fred decided to take up the offer, but not until the end of the school year. At the end of the school year, Fred built up his courage and went to see Fanny in order to pop the question to her. However, Fanny's response at the time was nothing more than a maybe. Fred then committed himself to write to Fanny on a daily basis until he was able to eventually convert her response from a maybe to a yes. He arrived back in Melbourne a few days before Christmas and travelled to Gippsland to catch up with and to share Christmas with his family. Fred's career as a grocer began on New Year's Eve of the year 1881. This is an image of the number one branch of what was later to become Moran and Cato. At this time, Edwin had two shops in North Melbourne and in Fitzroy. At an early stage of their operations, Edwin and Fred developed a set of principles on how best to further develop their business. Among the items agreed was the principle of setting up a cash-only model with no selling on credit, and also a principled commitment to look after the staff employed in the business. The cash-only model enabled the business to achieve a better turnover and hence to offer somewhat lower prices than most of its competitors. Expansion of the business happened quickly. By the end of the year 1882, a partnership had been agreed and the business was now known as Moran and Cato. Three stores in Prahran, Clifton Hill and Brunswick had come on stream, bringing the total to five. In December of 1884, Fred returned to Invercargill to finally wed his Fanny and to bring her back so that they could move into the flat above the new Moran & Cato shop in Smith Street, Collingwood. This slide shows a promotional leaflet published in order to promote the opening of the 11th Moran & Cato store in East Brunswick. Amongst the items of interest are the promotion of the chain as being the cheapest and best grocers, running a cash-only operation, and also closing on Wednesday afternoons as a way of offsetting the need for staff to work on Saturday afternoons. This was a great step forward for staffing conditions at that time. The rapid expansion of the chain continued during 1885 and 1886. During this time, the chain extended to 19 stores, making it Australia's largest chain. The early 1990s saw a major depression in Australia, and many businesses suffered severely. The Moran and Cato chain, however, suffered much less than many of its competitors. This resulted from a number of factors. The cash-only model reduced the chance of losses, and at the time, the chain only owned two of its 45 shops and sold a product range that was needed by customers regardless of the economic conditions at the time. During the next few years, the chain expanded, although at a slightly slower rate than before. It was also at this time that Fred became involved in the development of the Rosella Preserving Company. He became chairman of the Rosella board and established a close and ongoing relationship between the two companies. In 1909, the Moran and Cato's chain expanded its operations into New South Wales, and within 3 years had set up 15 shops in that state. During a period of consolidation, Moran and Cato expanded its operations both in Victoria and in other states. During the 1920s, the business had expanded into nearly every sizeable town in Victoria and, to a lesser extent, in New South Wales as well. The business had also expanded its operations into Tasmania. Moran and Cato also set up wholesale businesses in Victoria and New South Wales in 1924. Fred made a conscious decision that he was not going to set up a branch in Stawell, however. He retained a strong sense of commitment to the community of his early days, and as a result, didn't want to risk the livelihoods of the proprietors of existing grocery businesses in that town. By the time of Fred's active retirement from business, Moran and Cato had 162 branches spread over three states, about 1,000 employees, as well as more than 1,000 in the linked Rosella Preserving Company. The business formula, initially developed by Fred Cato and Edward Morin back in 1881, continued to work successfully for more than half a century. This formula included cash-only operations, no sales of alcohol, manufacturing and blending of its own products, as well as developing factory and wholesaling operations to support the company's chain of shops. This slide is a photograph of Morin and Cato's Donald branch in 1940. As you may be able to work out, their location at 94 Wood Street is in the building now occupied by Hardingham's Plumbing and Electrical. The shop also offered deliveries. Here we have young Alan Barr, nicknamed Nimbus, astride his Morin & Cato delivery bike. This photo is also dated around 1940. I haven't been able to trace Alan, although the Barr surname still appears in the local phone book. At about the time of his 70th birthday, Fred Cato returned to his birthplace to show his support to the people of Stawell. He donated £100 for every year of his life, a total of £7,000. His donations were spread amongst the hospital, local council, schools and colleges, and numerous religious bodies in the town. Unfortunately, Fred's health was on the decline, and on the occasion of his 77th birthday in 1935, he donated the largest sum ever received to the Lord Mayor's Hospital Fund. Fred died several months later. It has been estimated that during his lifetime, Fred Cato gave away some £200,000 to hospitals, teaching and religious institutions, and also the needy through the Fred J. Cato Charitable Fund, which still operates today. Frederick John Cato is truly remembered as Australia's merchant prince. I finish by returning to the image of the Morin and Cato logo. The message embedded in this logo is, "We keep trough." When we keep trough, we not only keep our word to someone, but we also offer help, defence, or whatever else he or she might need. This was the whole of life philosophy of Frederick John Cato.